Welcome to Tales of a Perrepreneur with your host, Dr. Biz, aka Jamie Reeves.
Welcome to Tales of a Perrepreneur, a podcast that tells the stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And if you are a business owner and parent, I salute you, as they are two of the hardest things you can do, and you are doing both together. I'm your host, Jamie Reeves, aka Dr. Biz, and on today's episode is a guest who specialises in curating high-ticket offers and elite client journey maps. Luxury sales strategist Deep Bajwar has 14 years of expertise working with and for high-net-worth individuals in the luxury industry, but her background came from studying behavioural psychology and has a deep understanding of human behaviour. Over the years, she's had the honour of being featured in prestigious publications like the Sunday Times, the Telegraphs, and on platforms like the BBC. All of this while raising two children and running the family home. Please welcome to Tales of a Perrepreneur, Deep Bajwar!
Hi, Jamie.
Morning, Deep.
Morning, Jamie. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. How are you?
Yes, I'm good. I'm excited.
Excellent. So I'm going to go straight in there. Why the luxury market? What's wrong with us common people?
But the thing is, luxury is for everyone. And this is what I'm really passionate about. Luxury should be accessible for everyone. For me, it was a journey. I don't come from that world, but I have learned and really worked hard to understand how people in that world move, what it is that they're looking for, how I can look after them. And so even though I don't come from that world, I've really worked hard to understand them and know how to serve them and look after them. And what I've realized is they're not that different from everyone else. And there are some key things that people want all across the board. We all want nice things. We all want to be treated well. We all want to be thought of. We want the details. We want all of these things, and they all matter to us all. So it's not that anyone is any less than anyone else, but it's about making luxury accessible to everyone who wants it.
I think that's really exploded over the last few years as well. As if just going by watching kids football, you see all the Moncler jackets and the Palm Angel hoodies and things like that. It's really kind of filtering into what I call common and ordinary people, I guess. So how did you start getting into that world? What was your first kind of exposure to that?
So my first business was an events company. So it's Opulence Events London. Ran that for, 13, 14 years into lockdown and just beyond it. And when I first started, I was working on events that were probably in the region of £30,000 to £50,000 events. And I scaled that from working with clients that were spending £100,000, £250,000, £500,000 to £1 million plus on event. And I wanted to move upwards within that. One, because I wanted to make more money, and you can charge more because you're doing more. The budgets are bigger, there's more work involved. People are used to spending more money, and you're working in bigger venues that cost more, and there's so much more excitement around it for me personally. So I never shy away from talking about money. I like money. I wanted to make more of it. Where can I make more of it? In this end of the industry. But it was also a creative outlet. So the more that people are spending, the more days of events they tended to have, there was more opportunity for me to be creative. And I realized I'm putting all of these proposals together, and actually there are some people that aren't able to do these things. And I understand that they're not able to, and it's absolutely fine. But I want to create these events. I want to have this out there. I want to have these elements and create these designs and bring them to life. And so for that, I need to work with clients who have got a bigger budget. And so I needed to move into the luxury end of the market. And that's how I ended up there. Working very slow, very steadily, very hard, very cleverly, and got there.
So did that take a bit of a mindset shift then when you first started working on events that were kind of 30 to 50 grand to them working on £1 million plus events?
Yeah, I think it happens slowly. I think there's a creep when it comes to mindset around this, because you have to see it to believe it a lot of the time. And so I would take my chances, and I would always put a proposal together that had two different options within it. So one that was more kind of within what I knew the budget was, and then I would put one that was a little bit more expensive that had everything in it so that they could decide for themselves. And what I found is, as I was going through it, some people would cherry pick from the higher package and kind of move it in, and some people would just go for the whole thing. The people that just went for the whole thing, they were my people, because I wanted to do absolutely everything together. And so it was understanding, well, what made them choose that? What made them want those things? And understanding those triggers so I can actually create more around that, but also getting an understanding of what it is that they are looking for and realizing people will spend. And I think that was the biggest kind of mindset shift for me. People will spend a lot of money on things that they value. What we value is going to be different to what someone else values. So someone who is worth 20 million as an example, they've got a huge multi-million pound business, they have got children that they're wanting to create their weddings for, as an example, because we dealt with a lot of businesses and a lot of families, they're going to spend relative to their income. So they're going to spend, let's say if they spend a million on the wedding, For me, millions an insane amount of money. Even now, I don't think I'd spend a million on my kids' weddings. I just don't think I would do that. But to them, it's relative to their income. So if you're earning 250 grand, you aren't really going to spend a million to 2 million on the event that you're having. If you are earning, you know, 10, 15 million a year, then that's relative to your income. It makes sense within your bracket. So your spending levels are different to someone else's spending levels. And understanding that shift is really important because you are not your client within this. I was not my client. So I needed to understand that personality. I needed to understand that psychology and really work to provide them with what it is that they need and what it is that they want and value. Value more than anything. Because it's not as though they're just going to spend money. The wealthy are not just going to spend money here, there, everywhere and frivolously. But they will spend money if they value something. So what do they value? How can I bring it to them? And how can I help them see that this is the thing that they want?
Yeah, that was one of the very first lessons that I learned in business, is that you are not your customer. And that was really important for me, because I went from being sometimes working in pubs and clubs as a singer to then working in these really nice 4 or 5 star venues at a wedding. And yeah, obviously the price difference from
sitting
underneath the dartboard to being at somebody's 5 star hotel wedding is very, very different. And yeah, it is a little bit uncomfortable. It's just something that you have to do, isn't it?
You get used to it, but also you're not turning up to the pub in the same way you're turning up to that 5-star hotel. No. So your value has increased. You're going to have different clothing, as an example. You're going to have a different setup. You're going to give more time for that setup, for the kind of the pre-setup and for the de-rigging afterwards as well. You're going to work that room differently. You're going to create different moments for those people as well. And so, yes, you're charging more and you're in a different space, but you're not delivering the same thing. You're delivering something that is of value to what that particular client wants. And so then the cost is, of course, naturally going to be more. And it's also justified to be more as well. And then as your personal value increases and your kind of your visibility and your own personal brand grows and people get to know who you are, then of course that's all something that becomes chargeable, because now you are a name and you have increased your own self-worth, and that is something that we are able to charge for, as long as we are also increasing the value of things alongside it. So we don't just up our prices for the sake of upping our prices. We never do that. It doesn't make sense. It's not ethical. And honestly, it just doesn't work. You have to make sure that the value is there.
Yeah, value is a very big key proposition in all of this. So I'm guessing a lot of the people who are listening to the podcast are going to be asking this question: how do you target these high net worth individuals?
There's lots of different ways, and this is the thing, it's not just one thing. It's a lot of networking in the right places. So it's understanding where you need to turn up. But before you are trying to figure out where you should turn up, you need to know where your ideal client is going to be. So where are they going to be? How do I get in the room with them? And how do I converse with them as well? And so understanding who those people are is key, but also what have they been up to lately? What do they stand for? What are their values? What research can you do on them beforehand? If you are going to any kind of networking event, I would always say try and get an understanding of who's going to be in that room. Either ask the organizer, have a look if that event has got like an Instagram page or anything like that. Ask around, who, you know, are you coming to this event? Do you know who's going to be there? When you know that, you can then go and do some research. Through your research, you can then target, okay, there's 3 people in this room. I really need to speak to these 3 people when I get in the room. Now you're networking with intent. You're not just networking for the sake of turning up, having a nice glass of fizz, and having a friendly chat. We love doing that. I mean, that's always fun. But we need to network with intent. So when you turn up in that space, you need to identify where those people are in the room and try and work to have a conversation with them. Is there someone that can give you an introduction to them? Is there someone who you know that's already talking to them? Or can you just go boldly and just introduce yourself and say, I was really looking forward to meeting you and having a chat with you. Do you have a second? Or, you know, I was looking at your LinkedIn the other day and I found it so interesting when you talked about XYZ. Show them that you are interested in them. And I think when you turn up with authenticity and you are genuine, people find that really endearing. I know I do. I'm sure you do too. When people just want to come up and just have a nice chat, you want to give that person your time. And so thinking about staying in that mode and being really curious about the person is going to be so much more impactful than thinking, well, what do I want from this person? So we have to think about, I just want a relationship with this person. That's all. I just want them to know who I am, or I just want to get to know them. And that's a slow burn, especially with the higher end of the market. It's not a one and done thing. It's about turning up time and time again. In psychology, there is the concept, and actually when I was at university, we call this the love module, but it wasn't that. It was the relationships module. But it's about how you build relationships with people. And there's a concept of proximity, familiarity, and similarity. And these are three things to really lean in on when you're looking to build a relationship with someone. So the more that you turn up in someone's world, slowly and consistently, the more times that they see you, the more exposure they have to you, the more likely they are to build trust slowly over time. Because trust is not something, unless something huge happens, you don't really build it in one interaction. So it's about having multiple interactions, small interactions, over time that will build trust. And with the higher end of the market, in any market that you've got, trust is the biggest thing. And so if you're looking to build a relationship and get into this world, you've got to be, it is a matter of slow and steady wins the race, but you've got to be consistent with it. And you've got to be humble about it, I suppose, is what you need to have in your mind at all times. I can't think about what I can get from this. I just need to be here to be present and build a relationship. The rest flows from that naturally.
It's like a courtship then, really, isn't it? It's just like,
oh, yeah. You are trying to date. That's what you were trying to do.
So all this sounds very time intensive. So how do you balance being a mum and doing all this networking? How does that work for you?
Well, I'm not out every night, and that's impossible and exhausting. I turn 40, I am tired. I do not want to do those things. But, you know, I started this business when I was 25, so I had a lot more energy then. So in those days, yes, I would be. I didn't have kids. I would be. And it's a very big difference when you don't have kids, when you do have them, as to what your time is. You know, I want to be home in the evenings with the kids now. I want to be there for homework, bedtime, dinner, all those things. But in the early days, I didn't have that. I couldn't have that, because I needed to build up the business. So there is this, you know, thing where when you're starting a business and you're in the very beginning, or you're moving niches or trying to change markets, it requires a little bit more input from you to have that set up. Once you're then set up and you know where you're going and what you're doing and what events and things you need to turn up to, or what rooms you need to be in, or how you're going to get visible to the people that you want, then it starts to settle down. But I don't think there's any shortcut to success. I don't think there's any shortcut to creating and building something. It does require work in the beginning, and then it does settle down. So there's no kind of, in the beginning there was no balance, and that's the absolute truth of it. There wasn't that balance, but I worked it out with my husband. He's got a very busy job. I had a very busy business that I was trying to run. So we just tried to work it out. Okay, these are the evenings I need. Can you be home at this time so I can go? And it'd be like, yep, okay, I can do that day. We run by calendars. If it's not in the calendar in our house, it doesn't exist. It's not a thing. You're going out, are you? Well, it's not in the calendar. I'm sorry. No. It's just about that. So we always have this race to the calendar. But it's the only way that our lives will work, is if we're really organized. And luckily, he's very organized as well. So it helps us. We also have a really great system around us. So we've got lots of family. We've got really good friends. And they help. And we help them as well. So it's a matter of just having like a village as well to really help you have more time to do the things that you need to do. I think if you're a person on your own, you've got to adjust what it is that you are able to achieve. And there's loads of things. We're so lucky. We're in an age of being online. You can do a lot. You can be hugely visible. I only now work Monday to Thursday officially. I still dip in and out of work on Fridays, but it's meant to be my day for me. But I can't help it. But that's out of choice. It's not necessity. And I don't work evenings anymore. But up until 2-3 years ago, I was working the evenings for this business, my coaching business. But that was nothing compared to the events business. That was every weekend, every single evening. It was either client meetings, supplier meetings, venue meetings, networking, events. You had to be out and about in the events industry. That's what it really is about. If you want your face to be known, You have to get out and about and show your face. And you have that in the coaching industry as well. You need to turn up to events where people are going to be. You need to get on stage. You need to get on podcasts and all of these things. But you can make it work for you, but not at the beginning. I think in the beginning, it does require a lot more input, and then it settles.
Do you think that with the age of social media, you can replicate some of that networking online now rather than do it face-to-face?
Well, definitely. I think it's been a huge advantage for all of us. And I think if it hadn't been for lockdown, we wouldn't all be as used to this as we are. So before that, you would do it, but you wouldn't really feel like you would connect. But we had, 1 to 2 years of only being able to connect with people over Zoom. So we got quite good at it and understanding people. And there are some people that I have never met, and I class them as friends. And I feel really close to them, and we will talk on WhatsApp, and we will talk on, Zooms and things like that. But there's still, I believe, a certain magic to being in the room with people and that energy. And I really missed that for a while. And so last year actually was my year of just saying yes to everything. Anyone asked me for a coffee or a dinner or lunch, or do you want to come to this event? If I could do it, yes, I'm there. I did not let myself say, no, I'm tired. I don't really feel like doing that, because we were so used to just being at home and so used to hibernating and being safe and cozy. And I had to really push myself to get out of it, because for 14 years I hadn't had that. I'd only been out and about, and I actually really enjoyed being at home, but I was at risk of being a hermit, so I just had to force myself. No. And it was good for me. I loved it. I forgot. My God, I love being around people. I love being in this energy. And yes, online is amazing, but nothing replaces that in person. So they're both good if they're used in tandem with each other.
So you talked there, interestingly, about kind of saying yes to everything. But how important is saying no to things when you're building your business?
It's more important than saying yes. It's much more important than saying yes. You have to know when to say no. You could give your entire life and world over to your business if that's what you wanted to do, and people would take it. People would take your time. People would take your resources. People would take your energy if you're willing to give it. So the only person that can protect you and your energy and your boundaries is you. And that was a real lesson for me, because I came from, really serving people and looking after people. And so you're not used to saying no, particularly when you're dealing with weddings. It's very time sensitive for people. And then I kind of realized, but you're all getting married and this is my life entirely. And I can't say yes to everyone all the time because I have no life right now. When I first started, I would answer calls at 2 a.m. My phone would be on. I would pick up the call to the bride crying at 2 a.m. because she's had an argument with her mother or a mother-in-law. I would do that, and I would be their counsellor, because I came from a psychology background, so I couldn't really separate the two in my heart. I couldn't do it to them. And then I realised, actually, this is having a detrimental effect, and it was when I had the kids. So when I had the kids, I realised, hold on, now I'm going to be affected, the kids are going to be affected, my husband is going to be affected. So I've got to pull it back. And then it was, right, now I have office hours. And they would go up until 8 p.m, 9 p.m. sometimes, unless it was an emergency, but it has to be a genuine emergency. And there are rarely any genuine emergencies when we're doing something like planning an event or a wedding, unless it's the week before, then I was more available to them. So putting that in place helped me a lot, because I knew, right, 8 o'clock, that's going to be the end of it. And I could then be a bit more present. And then I started to get even more bolder when I realized, okay, clients are accepting this. They're understanding that things can wait. So I'm training my clients. I think that's really important. You've got to train your clients to how they interact with you. These are my office hours. You can contact me within this time. If anything comes in after this particular time, it will be answered the next day. You have to set your own boundaries. And now we have that set up, and I'm very clear about it, and I stick to it. Obviously, I mean, a client had an emergency last week and another one had one this week. I'm there. I'll jump on a Zoom. Like, yes, if I'm free, I will jump on a Zoom. Like, right, do you need help? Let's go through this. Or I'll send a load of voice notes, whatever it is. Because in that moment, you need help. And I can't separate myself from that urgency. But it has to be genuinely urgent. There cannot be weekly emergencies. So we can give now and again. And it's having that flexibility. And I think that's what it comes down to. There is choice. But you have to train your clients as to how you want them to interact with you. And then they will. So when they started to accept those boundaries, I put in a few more boundaries. Like, right, from 3 till 6, I'm not really available because I have to do the school pickup. I make dinner and then I settle down. And I was afraid to say I had children in the beginning. I was afraid to say that I had this personal life. Yeah. And it's the most bizarre thing, but you're trying to be so professional. And I came from a corporate environment, so I used to work in pharmaceuticals, so that's my sales background. After I studied psychology, I went into pharma sales. And I was trying to keep that same professional corporate environment within my business. It's just not possible. It's not a thing that was working for us. And I just thought, well, I went into business so that I could be more present for when I have kids, and now I have them, and I'm still trying to answer a call and cook and you know, change a nappy at the same time. This is ridiculous. I do not need to do this. I can say 3 to 7, you can message me, but no phone calls, and then I will give you a call afterwards. Yeah. Simple as that. Or if you want to speak to me, no problem, but there will be children in the background. And you realize actually people are quite accepting of that. They're very accepting. And we had like one or two clients over that span, that 10 years, when I moved into the luxury end of the market, who would question it. And then I would explain, I may not be the person for you if this is going to be an issue, but if you want full attention, I did give you my business hours, but if you want to call me outside of this particular time, it will be with that going on. And I'm okay with it if you're okay with it. And then they were fine about it. So it's down to you, and you've got to own it and be confident in what you're saying so that people accept it. If you're wishy-washy about it, people are going to be wishy-washy with you. You cannot break your own rules.
Yeah, that was one of the... When things went wrong with my business and I started rebuilding it back up, that was the first thing that I did back in 2016 was, right, I'm working now between 10 and 3 because then I can get stuff done. When the kids are home, I can give them attention. We can go and do the dance lessons. I can go and football practice and taekwondo and all those other different things. And it didn't have an impact on business.
It's surprising, isn't it? There's so much fear before you put boundaries in place and you think, but no one will want to work with me then, or that's really going to upset my clients and I can't risk that. And actually, it's the best thing that you can do for yourself. You're valuing yourself, and that's key, because then you've got more to give.
Yeah, definitely. So what's the biggest big business lesson you've had from your kids then?
Oh my goodness, they're always telling me stuff. They're really vocal children. They're always telling me different things. What lesson have I learned from them? I think they've taught me to have more fun, to just be a bit more present and have fun. I think kids are really good lessons in that type of thing, because we've always got one eye on the future, one eye on the present and what we need to do, whereas kids are all in the now. They're in the present and they live for now. And so when they come in and they ask, you know, to play a game of double or top trumps, or actually, can I show you this really amazing thing I made out of cardboard and all of your jewelry? Just like, okay, I will get fine, let's do that. Because for them, that moment is so important, because they're living for now. And so I've learned that from them, to just, okay, sometimes I can slow down and it's okay, it's not going to change anything. And my kids are very vocal. We're really open with communication with them. We're always trying to tell them all the lessons that we've learned. And I'm sure they're going to grow up and complain and say, oh my God, all they did was talk us to death about this, that, the other. But I see it coming through now. I see it coming through them. And now with my eldest, he's 10 and a half now, he's in year 6. He will say things that I've been saying, and they come back to me and say, but you did say that you have to have boundaries, and now you're asking me, but this is my boundary. I'm like, well, you're damn right. I don't really like this, but okay, fine. You can have this time.
One of my proudest moments was I took Charlie to Jack's match, and Charlie had played in the match, and they got beat something like 5-0. And one of the parents said, oh, you've been playing football then, how did you get on? He said, oh, we lost 5-0, but we either win or we learn.
Oh, I love that. Isn't that amazing? What a kid.
I didn't prompt him. It's a saying that I say to my team all the time. It's a saying that I say to my kids all the time. So when he came and said that to me was a proper proud moment. Yeah,
really proud. That's when you know, okay, these kids are going to be okay. I'm doing a good job. Yeah. We will get there in the end. My daughter said something to me the other day. Something happened where they didn't get everything that, I can't remember what it was. I think it was something that they wanted to get and it wasn't in stock or something like this. She turned to me, she goes, oh, well, in life you can't get everything you want, but that's okay. We'll have something else another time. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. You cannot get everything you want. Because I try and teach her about living life 80-20. 80% of the time, you know, you can influence what you're doing, or you can do things perfectly. But 20% of the time, things will go wrong, or you don't want to do them correctly. And that's okay. If we're living life 80-20, I think we're winning. You cannot be 100%. And I feel, as a recovering perfectionist, I was absolutely a perfectionist, I've really had to undo that in myself. And I don't What I mean, I'm Asian. In every Asian household, there is, you must get the grades, you must do all the activities, you must get the certificates, do the public speak, like every, you have to do everything 100%. And so you feel the pressure, but it's also become so ingrained in you that you want to do it yourself. But that required a lot of unlearning because you become very hard on yourself as well. I didn't get that, my God, what's wrong with me? I failed, and I really had to undo that in myself. You are going to fail in life, mm-hmm. and that's part of it. And I feel like now we have that narrative because of social media and everyone's talking about things. It's normal. We're normalizing failing. My first business did fail. It wasn't the events business. I had a catering company with events. And I realized I was paying for people's weddings because I was so bad at managing the costs of food and the chefs and things like that. And I was really struggling with it. So just under a year, I tried that business. I was like, right, I do not like this. I am not good at it. But what I am really good at is the planning side. So I'm going to take the catering out and I'm just going to push on the planning. So yeah, in essence, that first business failed, but I learned from it. And we moved on to the next business, which was the thing that I was very good at.
Yeah. So what is your relationship with failure like now then?
With
failure? What's your relationship with failure like
it's
now?
It's healthy. It's healthy. I'm all right with failing. It doesn't upset me. It doesn't worry me. I just think, okay, what else could I have done? So it's very much, I have an analysis mindset now. So what happened? What went wrong? How can I make it better? What else do I need to do? So I will, you know, we will do things and it won't work and just, okay, it's not, I don't take it personally. It's not about me. I just didn't understand something in here. Something went wrong in our process. Let's go back and try and figure out what went wrong, what could we change? And you bring in people to help you with things like that if you need to. Like, I did this and it didn't work. What do you think I could change? And I'm a really big advocate of bringing that into your business to help. I've had a lot of mentors over the years for overall things, but also for very specific things. Like, I really struggled with content plans and things like that. I wanted to talk about everything, so I need to get really clear on that. So I hired a social media coach years and years ago. What should I be doing? What should I be talking about? And that helped me. But I learned the process for understanding how to be clear on things, and then it just became ingrained in me. So we don't know everything, and we have to bring people in to help us. But failure is part of life. It's very normal. It's not to be taken personally.
Yeah, definitely. So you talked a little bit about bringing coaches into your business and into your life. How integral has that been in the growth of your businesses and you as a person?
Huge, absolutely huge. I don't think that, it's not like I think you can't be successful without a coach. I think you probably could be, but it will take a lot longer is what I found. When I was first doing things on my own, if I look at my first business, how long it took us to get to six figures in that business was so much longer than the second business. One, because I knew a bit more about what I was doing, but two, I had a coach. I had someone guiding me and helping me and say, you know what, now you need to do this, or you did that and that's not quite right. Let's try it this way. I've had an idea for you. Or this is the system, this is the process, and I need you to just stick with this. Having someone who helps keep you accountable, who helps you understand what you need to tweak, what you need to change, to introduce you to other people that help, to introduce you to concepts and different ways of doing things, and actually like real strategy is so important. You will get there eventually. I think if you're going to succeed, you're going to succeed. But if you want to get there almost guaranteed and you want to do it a bit faster, I really feel like a coach is going to help you with that. You've got to be aligned with the person. They need to be aligned with your values and you need to get on with them and trust them. Mm-hmm. But if you can find someone like that, and there are so many amazing coaches out there for so many different things, then you're going to fast forward yourself and your success.
Coaching, I think, buys you time and experience, doesn't it? Yes. It just helps speed that process up, and it gives you the experience that you could never have if you were just doing it alone.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to have coaches that are very different to you? So personality wise, so you're one of my coaches, and then I've got another guy called Paul Mort, who is probably the complete opposite to you. He's very laddie, and really kind of very loud. And I love the fact that you're both so different. Yeah. And I think that really helps me. Do you think that, is that something that you look for in a coach? Somebody that's very different to the way that you are, so that it helps bring you up in places that you might not have known you need bringing up?
I think that's really important. I love that you have variety in your coaching experience as well, because what it does, it brings more concepts to you and makes you see things much more clearly. I look for people that are doing things that I want to do and that I haven't yet been able to do. If I like the way someone is doing something, I think, you know, I want to learn from this person. I like what it is they're doing. I've seen the success that they've had genuinely, and I've spoken to a few of their people, and I'd like to have a chat with them. I always like to chat to them first and just see, all right, do we get on? We might not be the same, but it's important to get on with each other. And like, yeah. Can I listen to what you've got to say? Do I even small things like, do I like the sound of your voice? Because you're going to be hearing that voice a lot. So it's different things like that. You've got to think about it all. And then you jump in with it. I've had one particular mentor for the majority of my time, but she is very different to me in terms of how she does things. And I loved that because I've implemented that into my business. I didn't really, if I'm being honest, care for systems and processes to begin with. And I didn't love data. I knew it was important. All of those things were important, but I am a creative soul. And so the business side of things, I really had to work on and really make myself fall in love with it. So I needed someone who made it very simple and very easy so that I could understand it. And now I'm in love with the strategy side of things. I am a qualified, certified business strategist now. I love the data. Every time we're going through, I'm like, what was the open rate? What could we do? How many people click through? I want to know everything now. If I look at my insights on my Instagram, what could we change? How many people saved this? How many people sent it on? I love the data because now with the data at hand, you can make better decisions. But I tell you, I mean, I hated maths at school and I'd studied statistics as part of my degree and I hated it. I'll tell you this, Jamie, I studied so hard for maths more than any other subject. I had tuition every single Saturday. I would be in tuition from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. I would take the bus to the high street, to the library, sit there all day and go through all of my maths work because I was so bad at it. With all that effort, I only got a C. I had A stars, A's, B's, and everything else. I got a C in the subject that I put the most effort in. When you get that, you just realize my brain is not meant for this. I cannot math. It does not work. But funnily enough, if you put a pound sign in front of it, I'm good. I can work that out really easily. So it's about the motivation.
Yeah, it's changing that motivator to make it sync with your thoughts and things.
But I am banned from doing maths homework in this house with the kids. I end up confusing them.
Maths, the way they teach things now to the way that I was taught at school, I'm making myself sound prehistoric here. But it is completely different animal. And the thing that always makes me laugh from when I went to school is when they always used to say about calculators and exams, and they used to say, you'll never be able to take a calculator around with you everywhere.
Yes.
And now look what we've got on our phones.
Exactly.
Everything. So you say your husband's in business as well. So how much talk does that dominate then in family time?
No, he doesn't run a business. No, he works for a social media company. And he works within higher education for that social media company. But he is very good at what he does. He's very successful. He's worked really, really hard for it. And he's in sales. So our conversations often center around sales because what I teach is how to sell. Yeah. And it's really interesting because what he deals with are really large contracts. So it's almost the same thing. It's high ticket for his industry and what it is that he's doing. And so we have some really great conversations around value propositions and how you build relationships with people and achieve renewals and things like that and how you network. And it's the same sort of concept, the same thing. And we understand each other really well because of that. And we're able to help one another as well. So I can give him some fresh ideas because out here in the entrepreneur wild space that we have, it's so much more free. You're not restricted in a way to try new things and there's less red tape. Whereas when you're working for a company, there's systems and processes that someone has put in place that you have to follow. And so I can bring a different perspective, but then he can bring something that's much more streamlined in terms of a perspective and a methodology to what I do. So in that way, we have some really great conversations. I learn a lot from him. I think he's just super clever. I love listening to him. I love just listening in on his calls as well. I just sit there on the stairs, his office is opposite the stairs, and I just sit there with it, and his door's closed. I'm like, oh, you're doing that? Okay, that's really interesting. And I just love to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the thing that's pricked my ears up a couple of times is you mentioned systems and processes a couple of times. So how important do you think that is to individual businesses then in helping the day-to-day running?
Huge. It makes a massive difference. Like I said, I didn't have systems and processes in the beginning. And then when we started to create automations for things, when we started to put in some real good processes for not just the automations and the tech side of things, but actually our clients and their customer journey, it helped increase the satisfaction amongst our clients. It helped free up our time. It helps you give a better experience to your clients, but it also helps you reduce down the amount of input that you're having to give to something so that you can concentrate on the other elements of the human-to-human contact. There's so much out there that can help us in terms of our systems that really just frees you up. Now, you can then choose how to use that free time. Are you going to use it for yourself? Are you going to use it to check in with clients a little bit more? And that's what I love about it, because I love human connections. I want to speak to my clients regularly. What I don't want to be doing is sitting there trying to send them something, trying to give them access to something. I want that all set up for me. And so I have an OBM who's amazing, and she deals with all of that for me. I was trying to do it on my own in the beginning, and then I realized this is like the maths. You're not good at this. You need someone else to come in and do this for you. And initially I brought her in as, you know, just a few hours a week. Could you set this up for me? And now I cannot live without her. She deals with all of it. And as I've grown, she's grown. So her knowledge has increased. She's always learning, training, and then she can bring that back to the business and help me out with things that we've got. So we've got a call next week, because she's learned some new things. She's like, right, this is really gonna help. We need to get this implemented. Let's jump on a call next week. I'm like, yes. So it's not just me doing it. I mean, I love it, but I also know it's not the thing that I'm good at. So I needed to bring someone in who's better at it than me, because what I'm good at is this thing over here, and I really wanna focus on that. I don't need to be doing those things. I can outsource that. And so again, outsourcing and getting everything set up for yourself is so key to growth. I think when you realize when you're trying to scale a business, you cannot be the person wearing all the hats. You have to bring in the help that you need and send out the things that can be done by someone else. Doesn't need to be you, and you can still grow. And actually, you will grow more that way.
Yeah, that was very much key at the beginning of my business journey. There was a guy that I used to do a lot of courses called Perry Marshall. And he talked about doing $10 an hour jobs, $100 an hour jobs, and $1,000 an hour jobs. And if you're doing $10 an hour jobs and getting stuck in the weeds, then that's a really bad thing for you and your business, because that's easily outsourceable, because your time should be worth a lot more than $10 an hour if you're growing a business.
Yeah, absolutely. How much can you make in that time versus the amount that it's going to take you to do it? It's the same concept as having a gardener or having a cleaner. Yes, I could probably do those things. I could figure out how to get the lawnmower going. I could figure out how to do all of the other bits and bobs, what flowers to plant when. But is that worth my time? What do I actually want? Do I want the gardening, or do I want the end result? I want a pretty garden. I do actually like gardening, but I want a pretty garden. I want someone who's able, especially then when we moved house a couple of years ago, and it was our big move, and it's a bigger garden. I cannot physically take care of it myself. So I have a gardener that comes. He's what, 20? I think he's gone up now. He's £25 an hour. He comes. He will get so much more done than me, because he has the tools. He has the knowledge. He has the equipment. He has all of that ready. So I'm paying him to do it. I get to enjoy the net result of it, which is hosting my friends and family in my lovely garden, or kids running around and everything growing and it looking nice. That's the thing that I actually want. I don't want to be sitting there doing it myself. So we apply that same concept to the business. Do you need to do this £10 job? Can someone else do this £10 job?
Yeah, bookkeeping is a big example. If you've not got a bookkeeper, that should be one of the first things I think that you do, because if you're sat there entering all your own receipts into whatever package that you use, then it's just madness. So how do you find balance nowadays between business and running a family? How do you kind of make time so that you feel that you get the right balance for you and yours?
I mean, I am much better at this than I've ever been. This is probably my peak time when it comes to balance. And I work Monday to Thursday officially. Those are my kind of delivery days. Obviously, if we're launching or something else is going on, then yes, I work more, but it's about having the flexibility to do that. I now do not start any calls with clients before 10:30, and that's because I want to drop the kids. I want to be with them in the morning. I want to drop them off if I can, or if my husband's here, he'll do the drop off, whatever it is. We'll try and work that out between us. And then I want to go to the gym. My promise to myself was my Fit for 40 pledge, and I want to get that going. I want to be in the gym. So I build in that time so that I can come back, get ready. I get up around 5-6 o'clock in the morning, depending on what season we're in. In the summer, it's much earlier. And then I might do a little bit on my phone. I might open some emails. I might sit at my laptop and get something done quickly. Spend 15 minutes, half an hour, if I want to. And if I need to, then I'll do that before the kids wake up. And then it's my work day, and I'm really intense with my work day. I will stop for lunch, but I do treat that very religiously. And actually, if you've got 5-6 solid hours of work, that's way better than having kind of 8 to 10 hours a day, but you're faffing in between. So it's very productive work that I'm doing and delivery. And there'll be breaks in between to go and chat to someone or to, you know, go for a walk if I need some fresh air, because when you're like this on the laptop, it can be a bit much. And then it's picking up the kids. They finish at 4, pick them up. And then cook. I love cooking, so that's a choice thing, and I'm quicker at it, so I get that done. And then, you know, we'll sit and I'll have time with the kids. I'll be present in their lives and get all the giggles and the chat and the download of the day. And I love that stuff. And it's not every evening that I'm able to. Sometimes I will go out to an event, or I will go see friends and whatever it is that I'm doing. But 80% of the time, I am here in the evenings, and I want to be. And then it's the bedtime, which, you know, is just an absolute mess for anyone with young children, and it's a nightmare. So I never know how that's going to go, which is why I had to stop the evening work, because my brain just wasn't working anymore. I was exhausted, and I think this is part of getting older, but you adjust to how you are and how you're feeling, and that's the flexibility of working for yourself. If you can't make something work for you, you're not turning up as your best self. Okay, I can adjust that. Let me change it to this so that you're turning up in a way that is beneficial to everyone. And then I will, if it's busy, yes, I will quickly flip open the laptop, get something done, do some bits on my phone. But again, that's out of choice. I've got very strong productive hours during the day that help. And I'm trying not to work weekends. Again, sometimes I will, but that's out of choice. But I spent so much time of my life, so much of it, working weekends because I was in events. I didn't have weekends. You know, Monday was my Sunday. For all of us in the events industry, Monday is our rest day. And then Friday is when the week kind of starts for us, right? We're busy, I'll see you Sunday night or Monday morning, as it normally was, because that's the life that you're living. And so when I was introduced to the concept of weekends, the concept of a summer, my God, that COVID summer, Jamie, tell me you didn't love it. A full summer?
Well, for me, there's two things that were instrumental for me changing my working hours. The first was Jack starting school. So Jack's just turned 15. 10 years ago when he first started school, I could not have Monday and Tuesdays my weekends anymore. So because most Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays I was out doing weddings and performing and doing different corporate events and things. So that was a massive wake-up call. Right, how do I create something that is going to help me still be involved in the family and not miss all those moments? And then the other thing, we bought a caravan a couple of years back.
Oh, fun.
That is about an hour away from where we live on the coast. Yeah. It's at a Haven Park.
So nice, yeah.
Different things are there for the kids. And we just can travel up there on either late Friday night or Saturday morning. To be honest, it's a different place to watch the TV on a Saturday night. That's pretty much how we have it. We have lots of barbecues and eat food that we like. But that's pretty much all it is. But it's made me have those weekends, where coming from an events background, that can be really, really difficult. But it would have never have happened if I didn't build those boundaries for clients.
Yeah.
Didn't build those systems and processes, and didn't create that false exit to mean that I can delegate those tasks to my team, so that instead of doing the £10 and £100 an hour jobs, I'm now focusing on, right, how can I really build the business?
Yeah.
How can I make those
key? You built the business for you.
Yeah.
This is what you've done, is created the business which works for you. I love your kind of the thing that you said about a false exit, because it's so important for people to, as you grow your business and you get to a certain point, to actually not let it rule your life. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to keep going and going and going and going and keep wanting and wanting and wanting. But at some point you have to say, okay, what do I actually want for my life though? That's work. That's the business. What does my life look like? Am I actually doing the things that I thought I would be doing? Do I need to change something? And you just need to stop sometimes and ask yourself that question and then work towards it. And I know that you're brilliant at helping people with that.
So it's yeah, because you can build a bigger business, but then sometimes the bigger the business gets, the more time it takes from you.
Yeah.
If you don't, and regular listeners to the podcast will probably think he's boring on about it again, but those systems and processes are so important.
They change everything. Yeah, it is boring. It's the boring stuff in your business, but it's the boring stuff in your business that will change everything for you. Those are foundations. They are so important. If you don't have that, you're going to be chasing your tail and running after yourself. And is that exciting for you?
No.
That's pretty boring that keeps happening and frustrating. So it's better to just get those things done, even if you think that they're boring. I thought they were boring, but they're the things that have really changed my life. They're the things that I'm more grateful for than anything else. So you have to think about that. And you did this with your business as well. You grew that so incredibly, and then you've created this false exit, and now you've got more freedom to do what you want in your life.
To do things like this podcast, to be able to go and with the kids to the football and dance things and caravan stuff. Yeah, it's cool. So you talked a little bit about self-care. Do you have a regular self-care routine that you do on a daily basis?
I have young children, Jamie. There is limited time. I mean, going to the gym is probably the biggest thing. Going to gym, going for a walk, that's probably my self-care.
Cool. Do you do any journaling or meditation?
I have a love-hate relationship with journaling. Sometimes I'm all in and I just love to do it, but it's not so much journaling my day or my thoughts. I like to write about what it is that I want. So I just like to write what I have this and I have that. And almost, yes, manifestation type things, but I believe in it, but not to the point that you just ask for it and it will happen, but it's more getting clarity in my head. What do I want? Yeah. And now I've got clarity. Okay, I can go and get that now. I can go and figure out the steps and reverse engineer the strategy I need to make that happen. So I like doing it for that sake, but I'm not a massive journaler. I did at one point. Like I said, I play. At the moment, no, I'm not. But so it can be so helpful.
So is that linked to kind of goal setting that you do then? Do you just put goals on a kind of like quarterly basis or yearly basis?
I mean, I have my big yearly goals and what I want to achieve, and then we break it down by quarter. So each quarter, right, what do I want to do? What is achievable and how do we get there? So it's all about working backwards from the big goal. So the big goal is, you know, as an example, if you want to make, I don't know, $500,000 in your business that particular year. Now I've got to break that down into quarters. Then I've got to go break it down by month and then by week. What are the things that I now need to do to make that money? What are the things I need to sell? How many do I need to sell of them? How am I going to do that? Layer that then with your marketing, right? People need to know about this thing. So I now need to go and talk about it in all of these places. How do I get to these places? So then you work backwards. I don't feel any of that happens unless you have a big goal or you have something that you're working towards, because you can have your eye on that. You know, right, this is the thing that I want. And then you can detach yourself from it to a certain extent, because now I'm doing the steps. So as long as I do these steps, I will get this. So I don't need to worry about that. That's going to take care of itself as long as I do all of these things. If I stop doing these things, that's going to be a bit trickier to get. And it's kind of like the same concept with the gym. I've got a goal in mind of my strength and things that I want to achieve this year. I'm not worrying about the overall. I set that goal. That's what I want. All I know is I have to turn up, do three strength routines, workouts a week, cardio every other day. If I just do that and I take care of all of the food, the result's going to come.
Yeah.
It can't not come if I do the work. So my job is just to do the work that was laid out. You can't think about the big strategy every day. You have to break it down and make it easily digestible and doable.
Yeah, definitely. So do you have family goals as well then? You talked about business goals and strength goals, but do you have stuff that you aim for with the family as well?
You know, it's funny because at the end of last year, we sat down with a massive piece of A3 paper and we just wrote down at the top, family must-haves. And everyone got to contribute to it in a different colour Sharpie, which my kids loved. What do you actually want? Like, how often do we want to have a movie night? How often do we want to go on holiday? How often do we want to go? My kids love centre parks. And it's incredible when you've got young kids. It's the best place to go, in my opinion, when you've got small children. So what, you know, how often do we want to go there? Do we want to have individual time with the kids? Yes. How many times do we want to go to cinema? Board games. How many like family board game nights are we going to have? We do something called crazy dinner. And it's been implemented weekly now. It's essentially the kids can have whatever they want. So I make a couple of hot things and then they can pick whatever they want from the pantry. Whatever. And I don't say no to them. and they love the idea. They absolutely adore it. And the thing is, it came out of me just needing to have an easy night one night. And you know what, just go for it. Have whatever you want. As long as you've eaten, I say to them, as long as you've had a protein and there's some fruit in there, I'm okay. Just eat whatever you want. And they love that. So now they wanted that weekly. So that's every Thursday night. So that is tonight. And kids love routine. So building these things in, we've got it stuck to the wall in the kitchen. They can then see, okay, cool, we've got these things going on. Or they pick us up on it. We didn't play board games last weekend. We didn't have a family movie. You know, quite right. Okay, we're going to make sure we do that. And so it just helps because for me, the family is everything. They're the center of my life. They're the center of everything. Everything I do and everything my husband does is for us as a family. And so if we're not doing that part right, for me, there's no point to anything else.
Yeah. They're the reason for everything, aren't they? And that's why we work so hard, but then sometimes we overwork so hard and don't rein it in and don't yeah. those bigger pictures, like those board game nights, like those family dinners, like those family movie nights. And I think it's really important to schedule those in and have some sort of plan for those. Yeah. So we're coming towards the end of the podcast. There's a few quickfire questions I'd like to ask. Okay. What are the three key behaviours you'd like to install into people?
Consistency, mm-hmm. being visible, and don't care so much what other people think.
Yeah, that's really important. That kind of bulletproof.
Don't care.
Yeah, the more you stick your head above the parapet, the more people will shoot at you. And
they'll shoot at you. It's not your problem. It's their problem. Yeah. You just do you, because people will always have an opinion and always have something to say. And really, they're not paying your bills. You don't owe them anything in life. And if you were to fall down tomorrow on your feet and you're not able to get up again, who's going to come and help you? Are those people going to come and help you? No. Unlikely, right? You will have some lovely people in your life, I'm sure. But really, you're on your own. So do you need to care what other people think? Yeah. No. You do what's right for you. In with ethics, right? With ethics, yeah. with your moral, you do the things that are right for you. But you can't. People give way too much credence to what other people think. I did it. It was part of my undoing of being a perfectionist. And now I can confidently say, I do not care. I'm very yeah. happy. Thank you very yeah. much.
What was the first record that you ever bought?
Oh, it was Blackstreet, No Diggity, that album that
what
came out.
What a tune.
Oh, it's so good. What was it, 98? 97, 98, something like that? 97, I think.
No, I think it was about... probably is, actually. Because the reason I remember that, Blackstreet's first album, Blackstreet,
yeah.
I played to death when I was summer season in Mallorca in 1996, so that's how I can remember.
It was 90. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because it was... I remember... holding onto it in the canteen queue like this, and it was a black and white one, wasn't it? The cover for it.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, those songs are still good today.
Yeah.
Any Blackstreet song comes on, it has held up.
But there's a shocking that I can't remember the "You Are My Everything" by Blackstreet was one of my wedding songs.
Off
the first album. It's shocking that I can't confidently say that that's the title of it. What's the favourite place that you've ever visited?
My favourite place that I've ever visited? I would say, so we went to Santorini, to Oia, for our 10-year anniversary. And, I mean, honestly, I think we could have been anywhere because it was just nice to be together and have time. And it was in the height of peak. It was 2019. And so it was really busy season. And it was the first time I went away in the summer. We got married in August. And so it was the first time we went away in the summer. And I was brave enough to do that in peak wedding season. But I had good teams and everything was set up. And I think I just loved the peace of that place. But we had someone who booked our travel for us. And they booked a particular room that had such a gorgeous terrace with the sunsets. And it was just so relaxing. And that was probably the best place that I visited for the moments that we had.
Great. And what are the three books that you would recommend for people to read?
Okay, I don't read as much as I used to, but I loved Denise Duffield Thomas' Get Rich Lucky Bitch. I loved that book. I thought it's fantastic. Daniel Priestley, Key Person of Influence. Yeah. Excellent. And then what can I say for another one? You know what? I don't have a third. I think those two are my favourite. There was one. I think it was Elizabeth Gilbert, Big Magic. Okay. And in the beginning, I don't think I've even got a copy anymore. We must have lost it when I moved house. But this was maybe 5-6 years ago I read that book. And it just felt like it opened things up. So yeah. Everything is achievable and you can do what it is that you want in life. And I just love that. So for me, those three books are really if you want to grow and you want your mindset to be clear and open, they're really good places to start.
I have to dig that one out. It's funny, I book sometimes that just key reading them and then key things happen after reading them. For me, it was Would It Make the Boat Go Faster by Ben Hunt Davis, I think his name is. He's an Olympic rower. And that really skyrocketed my thinking. So it's
concepts, isn't it? It just changes your thinking.
Yeah, it's timing, I think, as well. So, Deep, thank you so much for joining me. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram. It's under Deep Bajwa Strategist. You can find me on Facebook with a very long name, but if you put in Deep Bajwa, you'll find me there. And then I've also got my free group on Facebook, which is the Luxury Business Lounge.
Deep, thank you very much for joining us on Tales of a Power Entrepreneur. Ladies and gentlemen, Mrs. Deep Bajwa. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie.
We'll be right back.